Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you, and she's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. This October 13th, 2015 edition, episode 59 of Nature Bats Last comes from you to you live from the Mud Hut in southern New Mexico. Our thanks to Afrozen for his theme song contribution, and you can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. Today's show features a conversation with Paul Fallon. We'll be taking calls for him and us as well, and please call us toll-free at 888-874-4888. That is toll-free at 888-874-4888. And while you're settling in and preparing those questions, Guy has a comment to kick off the show.
Thanks, Mike. Our guest is bicycling around the country right now, and the studio just left a message for him on his cell phone, so hopefully he'll weigh in shortly. Anyway, I had intended to include the following tidbit as part of the climate change update, but it's just too juicy to wait. I am a Twitter with anticipation, so I'm going to bring it up first thing. From the BBC yesterday, October 12, 2015, comes this headline, Alaska mulls extra oil drilling to cope with climate change. That's right, folks. Alaska Governor Bill Walker says expanding the search for oil is necessary to pay for the damage caused by climate change. Never mind that burning oil and other fossil fuels is the primary culprit underlying anthropogenic climate change. The governor points out that the Trans-Alaskan Pipeline, a major source of revenue for a state with no income tax and no sales tax, was built to carry 2 million barrels a day. It's currently running at about 25% of its capacity as existing oil field production declines. Meanwhile, Kivalina, an isolated community of 400 Native Americans, must be evacuated because of sea level rise resulting from anthropogenic climate change. This is peak oil running headlong into climate change. The governor says, and I quote, "We are in a significant fiscal challenge. We have villages that are washing away because of changes in the climate," end quote. Kivalina is one of a dozen villages in this situation. When asked if extra drilling was needed to pay the millions of dollars necessary to fund the evacuations of these villages, the governor responded, quote, "absolutely, in a responsible way, as we have done in the past," end quote, poking my fucking eyes out. There you have it, Coke fans. We'll continue to bomb this village called Earth under the auspices of saving it. Responsibly, of course, for us. Thanks, Mike, for letting me squeeze in that little tidbit at the top of the show. I'm looking forward to today's interview. Please give us a heads up about our guests.
So, real quick, though, about what you just talked about, when he says absolutely in a responsible way as we have in the past, like when we moved the natives out of there in the past, like because we wanted that land in the past?
No, we're burning oil responsibly.
Oh.
Yes, we're being responsible about how we drill for oil in Alaska, including on the North Slope.
Okay.
Yeah. You can tell it's responsible because... Oh, wait. I have no idea how you'd tell if it was responsible. Instead of going to our guest, maybe we should go to the into the show, the climate change update?
Yeah, let's go to the climate change update.
Yeah, only it really won't be the end of the show, will it?
No, it'll be semi the beginning of the show.
Okay. So as we wait for our guests and we wait for your calls, 888-874-4888, I'll provide a little update about climate change. In response to a question on last week's show, I described additional data regarding methane emissions from small lakes and ponds. The information is part of feedback number 28. I missed a report from the Barents Observer a day before we broadcast last week. It was titled, Melting Ice Releases Greenhouse Gases on Land. It described a paper in the September 10th, 2015 issue of Geophysical Research Letters titled, Rising Methane Emissions from Northern Wetlands Associated with Sea Ice Decline. As you can probably tell from the title, actually both titles, the journal paper demonstrates that, quote, rising wetland methane emissions are associated with sea ice retreat. This is yet another example of the interactions among self-reinforcing feedback loops. As sea ice declines, methane emissions from these small bodies of water contribute to further decline of the sea ice. The two factors reinforce each other. They sort of play off each other. One accelerates the other, and vice versa. More evidence of these types of interactions is on the rise. A paper in the October 5th, 2015 issue of using my own pronunciation of that. if we use the English pronunciation of that, that would be the October 5th, 2015 issue of Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society A. And that paper takes the average of two conservative warming scenarios offered by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and concludes frozen soil carbon, found primarily in the form of methane, responds rapidly to warming. Specifically, for every 1 degree Celsius of global warming, the amount of permafrost carbon that enters the atmosphere is equivalent to a year and a half of global carbon dioxide emissions.
Wow.
That's astonishing. 1 degree C, which is... We're slightly above 1 degree Celsius right now.
But we stay in a 2C, guys.
Oh, yeah. Don't get me started. You're going to have me poking my eyes out. We're only 10 minutes into the show, and it'll be the second time. Thanks for that. The mainstream scientific community has finally realized habitat matters with a focus on food. And this is a major disadvantage associated with most climate scientists in that they don't have a degree in biology or an understanding of biology. So if you take a purely physics approach, you don't understand the whole concept of habitat. A paper in the October 2nd, 2015 issue of Science reports that a stable food web was critical to the few species that survived the most severe mass extinction event in planetary history, the Permian event. So if you don't have access to a stable food web, you're not going to make it, based on information from the Permian event.
That seems kind of like a big piece missing out of your climate science degree. You know, if you're a climate scientist and you don't know anything about habitat.
Right, absolutely. But, again,
I'm not saying they don't know anything, but,
right. No,
it's
I
not their focus.
Most academic scientists are stuck in their silos.
And I think that's where we find a little bit of trouble with, or I think that's where Daniel Quinn talks about how food makes people. And people don't understand
Right. Population
growth. You can't have population growth without food.
Right.
Therefore, you have population decline without food.
Exactly. Absolutely. And that's what I like about that short little 4 or 5 minute piece in the newsroom from November of last year,
Right. Almost
a year ago. They introduced that guy as having a PhD in climate science.
Mm-hmm.
Which was impossible given his age, because there was no such thing as a PhD in climate science when he would have been in graduate school.
Yeah.
But they also pointed out that he has a degree in biology, so he's actually able to connect those dots.
Yeah.
I think that was an important part that probably went right over the heads of most people.
Not that you would know the answer to this, but is that a rare combination?
It is a rare combination. Yeah, in my experience, most climate scientists do not have a degree in biology.
Mm.
So they have degrees in physics, in atmospheric science. I mean, climate scientists are drawn from throughout the academic campus, from the whole range, but most of them don't have a degree in biology or even sufficient background in biology, in my opinion.
And you also mentioned that the character on the show, based on his age, would not have had a climate science background, PhD. When did that come into play?
Right. Among the first PhD minors in the academic sciences. And this is a PhD minor. It was at the University of Arizona when I was there. It came into being about 15 years ago.
And what does a minor generally entail as far as, I mean?
It entails taking about 15 credit hours of graduate coursework. That's it.
Yeah. What is that? That's like two
that's
and a half classes?
Five classes.
Okay.
It's not five one-semester classes. Yeah. That's not very
but
much.
But if you throw a lab in there, it's only two classes.
Well, the funny thing is, you know, there's not much emphasis on biology, and that's only a minor because most academic programs don't want to add another degree,
yeah,
another degree field. And I would argue that climate science, and most other academics would argue this as well, that the climate science enterprise is so multidisciplinary that it would be difficult to assign a major to it.
Okay.
Because it draws from so many other things.
So we had, at the University of Wisconsin, one of my roommates was in the School of Meteorology. So he's a meteorologist for the National Weather Center in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Is he technically, is he a climate scientist or not?
No, he's a meteorologist. Okay. Sometimes meteorologists, well, there's a broad spectrum there, too. The field of meteorology includes people who give weather forecasts.
Yeah.
Right? And so they know the weather.
Yeah.
More than they know anything about climate.
Right.
But then there are other meteorologists who actually have studied climate science, including paleoclimatology.
Yeah.
So they actually know what's going on. So it's one of those labels that can be misleading. You can call somebody a climatologist. They don't know anything about anthropogenic climate change.
Right.
In fact, a whole bunch of the weather forecasters who have degrees in meteorology are climate change deniers with respect to anthropogenic climate change.
Yeah, that was my next question is the amount of people out there that do the weather.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
A couple more points from the climate change update. A paper in yesterday's issue of Nature Geoscience reports that the Antarctic ice is melting so fast that the stability of the whole continent could be at risk by, you guessed it, 2100.
We have like a little up in
there. Oh, man, we'll be fine. No surprise about the date, of course, but the paper uses two emission scenarios to predict a doubling of surface melting of the ice shelves by 2050. That's a prediction regardless of emission scenarios.
Mm.
And this only deals with carbon dioxide, of course, as do most of the forward-thinking models and scenarios. With one emission scenario, Antarctic ice shelves would be in danger of collapse by the end of the century, all of them. So we're talking about all of Antarctic ice.
Yeah.
This is a major admission from a very conservative source.
But it's still end of the century.
It's still end of the century.
For those of us that have plans.
And even 2050, they're pointing out,
right,
you know, that all of the ice shelves, there will be a doubling of melting of all the ice shelves between now and then, regardless of the emission scenario. So that's locked in.
Yeah, I don't think it's actually possible. I mean, clearly, you know this because of the pushback you've received, that you cannot say anything within literally the next 5 to 10 years because you're looked at as a freak.
No, absolutely.
So you have to say the 2050s and the 2100s and the 2Cs.
Right, and there's pushback, of course, from the general populace, which says that the weatherman can't even tell you what's going to happen tomorrow.
Right.
How can you predict what's going to happen in 5 years or 10 years?
And again,
years,
yeah,
right?
The confusing weather and climate.
Right,
right.
Exactly. And then even within the staid conservative halls of academia, to say anything is going to happen within the next decade,
yeah,
is just anathema.
And so is that part of the problem, is there is such a compartmentalization going on in academia that they cannot connect things, or just choose not to because of the workload?
It's absolutely a big part of the problem, and it's not because of the workload.
Not everybody's a workhorse like you.
Well, I mean, seriously,
yeah.
if you're a professor in the sciences at a major university, as I was, mm-hmm, you're required to teach one, maybe two classes a year.
Yeah. That's, so the majority of your work is research-based.
Right.
Yeah.
Research, scholarship in one form or another, yeah, that leads to material being written. You know, most of my colleagues at the University of Arizona spend less time outside the classroom than they did inside the classroom, preparing and grading and so on. So if you're teaching 3 hours a week,
yeah,
and that's what that amounts to, right? 3 hours a week, for two semesters in a row.
Yes.
And then you spend another couple of hours a week prepping for that stuff. You're talking about 10 or 15 hours a week total.
Right.
And you're getting paid for 40. That still leaves a lot of time to work on other things. So you could reach out across the hallway and interact with people outside of your discipline.
Say the biology department.
Say in the biology department. But there's no reward system to do that, and there's plenty of lack of rewards and even punishment for people who reach out across the silos in the academic environment. So there's a lot of talk about interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary activity, but there's no money for it, there's no encouragement for it, and ultimately the entire reward system is based on peer review, and those peers come from your department and from your college, not from across campus.
Right. So you need to stay in that department and show off, so to speak.
Right. So you need to show your stuff within atmospheric sciences if you're in the atmospheric science department, and then you're evaluated within the Department of Science.
Okay.
That doesn't say anything about what's going on over in biology.
Right. It almost seems like it's a perfect reflection of the division of labor that has happened over time as a result of civilization.
Yes. I mean, there is no finer example of civilization, in my opinion,
than
the ivory tower.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, people are paid to think, are rewarded to think, narrowly but deeply, and not interact with a bunch of people, instead create the contemporary equivalent of the... what's it called when you have a bunch of people working for you back in the Middle Ages? You had a bunch of apprentices.
It's
essentially an apprentice program, and the apprentices, not to be confused with slaves, are your graduate students, and they go out into the world and continue to promulgate your fame by doing similar work as you're doing.
These are your TAs doing classes for you.
Yeah.
Sometimes, and you're right, that 3 hours is not even taught by you.
Right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And these are also not just TAs, but RAs, research assistants instead of teaching assistants. And so these are folks who are conducting research that the faculty member wrote a grant to get money to do.
Yeah.
So I write a grant, I send it into the National Science Foundation after it gets rejected four or five times because it thinks way too far outside the box. Finally, you get constrained into the academic silo, and then I have money to support two graduate students for 5 years each to do the same kind of work I'm doing, because you can't stretch too much,
right?
Or you get punished for that.
Well, and these are the folks that, talking about the climate scientists, these are the folks that are delivering the information that we have to, you specifically, are deciphering, and it seems like it's a pretty limited point of view considering, you know, like we talked about, they don't have a great depth of knowledge in something like biology.
Absolutely. And, you know, Noam Chomsky has been talking and writing about this for years. It's okay to have a conversation. It's okay to have a debate.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay to have rancorous debate, as long as it doesn't range outside of the current system.
Right.
As long as the debate stays within the confines of the set of living arrangements we already have.
Yeah.
So we can debate all day about whether 2 plus 2 equals 4.
Right.
But there's no way we're talking about 2 cubed.
No.
We have a caller on the line. I have one more final climate change update. The bleaching of coral has been repeatedly mentioned in the mainstream media. Yes, even the mainstream media. This is among the largest coral bleaching events ever recorded, and will undoubtedly surpass all prior events. It's been reported in too many places to mention. So I won't.
Okay.
How's that for you?
That's great.
And we have our first caller, Mark from New York. You're on the air.
Hi, it's a great pleasure to speak to you. Approximately 3 months ago, I saw you in a debate or discussion on YouTube where a gentleman posited what seemed to be a technique for reversing climate change, where you non-invasively treat the remaining ice caps to increase the reflective power of the ice, or to make more ice. It seemed to be very reasonable, very non-invasive, What I didn't quite understand if you had an objection to that technique.
Thanks for your call, Mark.
Thank you, Mark. We appreciate it. I don't recall the conversation, of course, because it was longer ago than yesterday, but I suspect it falls in under the category of geoengineering or trying to use some set of tools created by civilization to reverse a process created by civilization. And so probably I was opposed to it on principle. You know, this is one of those situations where in theory there's no difference between theory and practice, but in practice there is. So I suspect somebody is positing that if only we do these four things, we can grow the ice sheets. And in fact, this is a major effort of the Arctic Methane Emergency Group. When you get to the specifics, however, of the Arctic Methane Emergency Group and the other folks who propose not only reversing sea ice decline in the Arctic, but increasing the ice cover in the Arctic, it gets a little sketchy because these are untested approaches. It's been quite a long time since Tim Garrett wrote his pioneering paper about civilization being a heat engine. He's followed that up with two papers. Nearly as I can tell, what the Arctic Methane Emergency Group proposes is using fossil fuel-powered motors to kick aerosols up into the atmosphere in the Arctic. And so burning more fossil fuels to overcome a problem created by fossil fuels. I started the show by making fun of the governor of Alaska.
Which isn't that difficult.
And it's not that big a stretch to where the Arctic Methane Emergency Group is headed, in my opinion. I have no doubt that they are doing what we just talked about, which is thinking outside the current system, and I appreciate that. But I just don't see how we can use fossil fuels to generate the aerosols, to kick them up into the atmosphere. Why don't we just follow the work of Tim Garrett and stop? Just stop civilization, period. And maybe start thinking that it's not all about us relatively wealthy middle-aged white guys who've been running the show.
Well, I wrote a piece on your blog probably 2 years ago about that, about how we tend to, and we the people who talk about these things, and we the people who, work in climate for a living and so on and so forth, we are an echo chamber of a lot of white males trying to solve issues that, quite frankly, a lot of white males have created. And so I mentioned maybe we should just shut up and start listening to people who are not, who don't look like us or sound like us.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And sometimes, you know,
let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater here.
Right. Well, I mean,
come on now.
Besides us.
Well, of course.
But, you know.
Keep listening to this show, but everybody else shut up.
Exactly.
I wonder how we got here.
But I think the difference is we're not giving solutions. Clearly, we're not giving solutions. Nobody seems to want to listen to anybody who's indigenous and who has never actually gone into this particular reality.
We're going to move those people.
Yeah.
After we drown them.
I mean, not that they would talk to us at this point. but you don't even have to ask. You can just look at what people are doing and have been doing for thousands of years and are still doing it. And some of these folks, by a miracle, are still uncontacted, barely. And just learn from that. There is no solving this, but there is a way to proceed. We just don't like that way. And honestly, you know, we're not capable of that way either. I get that. People are going to die, and people don't like to hear that.
Right. Yeah, but, you know, people are going to die anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Already, climate change is responsible for 5 million deaths of this.
Right.
At least 5 million deaths.
But people don't know they're going to die, quoting Stephen Jenkins.
Right, yeah. Yes, that's true. We're taking your calls, 1-888-874-4888, and it appears our guest for today, Paul Fallon, is out there riding his bicycle. So
somewhere.
This might be a call-in show.
It could be.
Another surprise call-in show.
You're listening to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network, and we are adapting to call-ins, just like we would try to adapt to the climate.
Adapt. I have a question that came from Facebook, and I think it's quite appropriate here. The question is, if you could address the entire Paris Climate Conference this December, but you were only given 5 minutes, what would you tell the gathered masses? What would you consider to be the most important part of your presentation, or would you try to summarize the whole shebang in those few minutes?
Run for your lives! Thank you.
That's a fine question from whoever was out there on Facebook and posted it. Sorry, I lost track of that. So what I would do is I would use the short message I posted on the blog beneath it, each essay for a month or two. It only takes a minute. So I'm going to read it again here.
Okay.
We are in the midst of abrupt climate change, which will soon obliterate habitat on this planet for our species. This event has precedence in Earth's history, obviously not involving humans,
right.
And it's irreversible at time frames that matter for humans. Civilization is a heat engine, and the planet is about to overheat. Our species, like all others, will go extinct. It's later than you think. I'm not suggesting that we give up in the face of certain death. I am, however, indicating that birth is a sexually transmitted disease that is proven lethal in every case. We all die. What matters now is how we choose to live. That's always been the case, although we often lose track of the urgency. And then when I was done with that, since I'd have about 4 minutes remaining, I suppose I would do some stand-up, or maybe I'd ruthlessly make fun of the government officials in the audience. Either way, I suspect I'd be pulled away from the podium long before my 5 minutes expired, so I wouldn't have to worry about the whole 5 minutes.
I'm sure Leo could fill the rest of your time.
Yeah,
DiCaprio.
Yes.
Let's bring up a movie star.
Leo DiClimateo.
Yeah. I heard he's going to do a movie on the Volkswagen debacle.
Really?
Yeah. Already, because of the, because if we fix the Volkswagens, I think we get a shot.
A shot at...
I knew it was the, I knew it was those hippies and those,
It's their fault.
VW microbuses.
While we wait for your calls at 888-874-4888, we do have a Doomer of the Week.
We have a Doomer of the Week, and it's courtesy of Lily, the flower in the desert. Eric Michaels qualifies at Doomer of the Week for posting this quote from Johanna Macy in the Near-Term Human Extinction Love Group on Facebook. Quote, "To live with sufficient realism and dignity to know we are right with that knife edge of uncertainty. We don't know how it's going to come out. There are no guarantees. Wait, there are no guarantees anyway," end quote. And that is our Doomer of the Week, Eric Michaels, quoting Johanna Macy.
And I like Johanna Macy's work, and that sounds a lot like us, actually.
Yeah.
It's, in other words, I think it's really awesome.
Yeah, wow. We are white guys.
Right, there's no certainty anyway.
No. I was watching Nova last night, and I was house-sitting, and the owners have a endless list of Nova on DVR. And so I sat and watched an episode on Petra, the city that was, that's in Jordan, I believe, currently in Jordan, and it was carved out of sandstone. And they kind of mentioned that it was the first original Las Vegas. In other words, a metropolis in a desert somehow being propped up by water. And they went through all the engineering and how they got water and created this oasis. And they were, the narrator seemed fairly impressed because he said something to the effect like, and this lasted for several hundred years. Like that was some sort of accomplishment. And that almost seems to be the thing, you know, like the United States, for example. You know, we've been around, you know, a little over two centuries, and we think that that's quite an accomplishment.
Right.
And civilization's been around for anywhere that you read from, you know, 12 to 10 to 20,000 years, depending on, you know, your development of it. That seems to be an accomplishment.
Right.
But living for millions of years prior to all of those events, completely... it's ignored, and it doesn't actually get referred to as possible ways to go forward. Because
right.
That's a success story.
Right.
Millions of years compared to a couple hundred, even a couple thousand.
The first 2.8 million years of the genus Homo is just irrelevant.
Right.
Because we have water coming through the taps.
Yeah.
And we have all these other nice, like food that shows up at the grocery store.
Yeah. Plenty of shelter to choose from that's already built.
I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm a huge fan of food.
Yeah.
And shelter.
Right.
And water coming through the taps. But this is not the only way to live.
No. And I'm a huge fan of actually civilization. I just know that it's killing us. I mean,
right. Yeah.
I at least know that.
And you don't have to look far to figure that out.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't. There are so many explanations at this point, all of which point to civilization as the whole predicament that lands us here. That, you know, you only have to read from any number of thousands of sources at this point to figure out where the story got started.
And so, as a, you know, I keep bringing back this because next week we're going to talk about climate scientists, and we're going to quote unquote try and clarify some things.
In other words, it could be the last show.
It could be the last show. But is this another example that they just can't make that connection between the climate and civilization because, I don't know, they don't have a degree in sociology or they, or city planning or, or anthropology?
Come on, let's go back. I mean, not to pick on you or anything.
Right.
But let's go back to, say, early April 2008.
Okay.
And did you posit any significant questions about the whole set of living arrangements there in Phoenix, Arizona?
Probably not, no.
Go on.
But, in my defense... My focus in my life, like much of the focus of, for example, a climate scientist, was not the climate or anything else to do with what was going on in the world. I was more of a, I was into figuring out what was going on in my community, socially, racially, actually, at that point. But I seemed to make a lot of connections based on what I was focused on at that moment. And if my focus happened to be the climate, I'd like to think, yeah, maybe I would look at the way we were living and what's affecting the climate. And I understand they are looking at that, but they never actually can quite pull the trigger and say, yeah, this is it, the way we actually are doing things, instead of giving me a reform version, an alternative version, a new economy version, a hopeful version. And, you know, it's fine if it's hopeful. I know I'm not going to get anything else at this point. But nobody uses the word civilization.
Right.
I never hear it. I never hear it in an interview. I never hear it in print unless it's somebody in what I would call the doomer realm, in the doomer world.
Right. So you started going down this rabbit hole, this story, and I want you to continue down that line because the work that you were doing at the time, which was teaching, but what you were teaching and what you were studying yourself led you to conclude that civilization is a predicament the first time you read about it.
I think...
So
yeah.
Let's talk about that, because a lot of people have come across the idea of civilization storing grains or industrial civilization. They can't even begin to understand why this is problematic.
Right.
That they can't even begin to understand why we can't use the tools of civilization to overcome the predicament created by civilization.
Yeah.
But you got that right away. So
I think I got there through, and I wrote an article about this recently, through oppression, through hierarchy. So I started looking at why I had an enormous amount of privilege and why my students, who were basically, some of them were undocumented, a large portion of them were not white, and why they did not have the privilege I had. And so I started to look at the set of arrangements and a hierarchy that was in place that is required to keep this all going. And we were studying at that point for a couple years in a row the Grapes of Wrath. And the Grapes of Wrath deals with white people, though, the story itself,
mm-hmm.
and white people that are feeling hierarchy, but they're also feeling climate.
Right.
And so I think a combination of studying oppression and then reading that book for a few years in a row really started to connect that these things are related. There is a reason why there are people on the bottom, so there can be people on the top, so we can keep this engine rolling, this engine which is civilization. And that's basically how I got there.
Right. I think that's a critical point, because you were aware of hierarchy, to take it a step further, patriarchy, mm-hmm. and going that next step in realizing hierarchy, patriarchy, oppression, whatever you want to call it, is rooted in this set of living arrangements.
Yeah, I don't think people make the connection between individual prejudice and systemic oppression, and systemic institutional supremacy.
You know who does make that link? Black people.
Right.
Women.
Yeah.
Brown people.
Right. But the people I deal with in my life, which is generally relatives and, you know, people I went to school with, people I try not to see in my newsfeed, but just happen to pop up, they don't seem to understand. And I had a long conversation with a police officer who I went to high school with online, and he's a detective, so, you know, he's been in law enforcement for a very long time and probably been pretty successful at it. You don't make detective just like that.
Right.
And we went back and forth and back and forth, and I don't know, it took me so long. It dawned on him, he just doesn't know what systemic means or institutional. He just can't see it. He knows that he, in his mind, treats people a certain way, therefore things are fine.
Right.
And those people that don't treat people as well commonly gets referred to as hashtag a few bad apples.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's the default, is that if we can just take care of these few bad apples, and it's the same way those folks, like that particular police officer, talk about people who are being oppressed. If those folks, those few bad apples, could just figure it out, work a little harder,
right,
put a little more dedication in, quote-unquote, take care of their families, then we wouldn't need all these social welfare nets and safety nets below them. And not realizing that there's a huge safety net for all of us, which is called civilization.
Right. And it supports some of us a lot better than it supports others of us. And those who are less well-supported, we refer to as losers, as people who just can't pull themselves up by their bootstraps and get on board with what we're doing. I do have a question coming from Facebook that ties in perfectly with this. Columbus, and how timely, given that yesterday is Columbus Day here in the United States. Columbus invaded a very peaceful civilization and remarked on their sweetness and innocence. Mm-hmm. If I'm doing the math right, that was 523 years ago. Then he was excited about how easily he would be able to enslave them with just 50 soldiers.
Yeah.
Isn't this awesome?
I can get them to do what I want.
With only 50 soldiers, I can get thousands of people to do what I want. The question is, how do we engender the sweet nature of the Taino and avoid the civilized methods of the Spaniards?
Well, I wrote another article about this for the Good Men Project.
You're quite the authority. Maybe we should have you on this show as a host.
My first article for the Good Men Project was right around Columbus Day, and I wrote an article about the psychosis of success. And short answer is, we have to realize that we are a conquered people. And so when Columbus came upon this hemisphere and came upon folks, those folks, he didn't recognize them because they had not been conquered. They didn't have a conqueror's mentality. And so he didn't recognize human beings when he saw them because they were actually being human. He only recognized conquerors, and his people had been conquered centuries prior. And so, of course, conquerors need ships. Uh-huh. People who are not conquered, they don't really need ships because conquering, like civilization, that's what it is, requires more, and it always requires more. So I think personally, until you stop the idea that you need more, which is a want, you get to the point where you just start to identify your basic needs, which I'd like to think you and I have begun that journey. We have started that journey, and it's been a journey of 7, 8, 9, 10 years living the way we're living. We're not nearly there. Mm-hmm.
Right.
But I think it's a process that you have to begin at some point and not worried about a timeline of, do I have enough time to do this?
Right. And so that brings to mind two lines from a movie I've never seen, of course, Mary Poppins.
Oh.
Have you seen it?
No, I don't watch that crap.
Are you kidding?
I teach you Bang Bang, but not Mary Poppins.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I think everybody except you and I has probably seen Mary Poppins.
I've seen highlights. I think they made a movie about the making of Mary Poppins.
No way.
Called Saving Mr.
Come
Banks.
On. So, like the highlight reel?
Yeah, I tried watching that.
For Twitter Nation?
I'm not going to fly somebody with a flying umbrella.
Okay, so frequently when somebody at the store asks me how I'm doing, as if they give a shit, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the cashier asks me how I'm doing.
I don't.
Yeah. And so sometimes I say fine.
Right.
Which is an acronym for fucked up, insecure, neurotic, and emotional. But they don't know that, so I just leave it at fine. But usually I say I'm practically perfect in every way. And they go, oh, well, that's funny. That's nice. And I say, yeah, it's from Mary Poppins. Oh, really? I didn't remember that. Well, I've never seen it, but I knew that. And so already I'm in this sort of argumentative mode with them.
You're a paper plastic, sir.
And then I say, it's not even my favorite line from this movie I haven't seen. Oh, now they feel like, you know, they're the cashier, so they have to engage with the customer.
They think you're probably going to sing something.
Right. So they say, oh, what is your favorite line?
I have no idea.
Enough, as good as a feast.
Enough, as good as, yes.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
We don't think that way in this culture. Enough, as good as a feast. It's pretty awesome when you come across people who do think that way.
Yeah. And I think we have.
You know, and I thought that the line was original to Mary Poppins. And as it turns out, I was reading Emil Zola's classic, The Earth, or I guess it's just Earth. I think it's 18th century, maybe 19th century. And I was reading an English translation, and there it is, right there, that exact sentence. On like page 37, enough as good as a feast.
And so Uncle Walt, like capitalism, fucking stole it.
Walt Disney
marketed
stole that line, called it his own, and made a bajillion dollars off that movie I haven't seen.
Oh, it's enough to feast niche. That's a good market. You make a lot of money in that market, Walt.
So there you go. Enough as good as a feast. But, of course, it's difficult to get people to admit that when they have spent their entire lives in a system that says more every single day, screams at us.
And that's the success.
More.
That's the psychosis of the success, is because that's what we're judged on. We are judged on what we collect, what we accomplish, and how people appreciate us. We really could use a caller, 1-888-874-4888. You're listening to Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network. It's a show about calling in today because our guest is apparently riding his bike across the United States. And we would love another call.
That number again is toll-free, 888-874-4888. And if you don't call in, then we're going to awkwardly stretch this thing out for, you know, another 20 minutes.
Well, let's talk about a little more about Paris and the climate conference, which is, I believe it starts at the end of November and goes into December?
The very end of November, I think the 30th or something like that. It basically is the first week or so of December.
And I just caught a part of Bill Maher again the other day, and he had the Secretary of Energy on, I believe.
Uh-huh.
And I can't remember the guy's name, goofy haircut. Looks like he's probably on the Supreme Court in 1875 kind of haircut.
You know, I don't follow any of that
political
national-level bullshit anymore.
He seemed pretty hopeful.
You could tell me his name is Walt Disney, and I wouldn't know any better.
He seemed pretty hopeful that things were going to go well at these talks, and much more would get accomplished, mainly because China has been a little more on board than the Republicans, I guess, what he was trying to point out, are always saying, well, why should we do anything? Because China, you know, the biggest polluter in the world.
Right, right. They passed us just a couple of years ago, so obviously it's all their fault,
mm-hmm.
and it always has been, in an Orwellian kind of way. Yeah, well, I've no doubt that emissions are no longer increasing as quickly in China because they're in the midst of an economic depression.
Right.
So they built all those cities they don't even have people for.
Well, they're having more children, which you mentioned last week.
Right. So they have these ghost cities that, in many cases, will never be occupied.
It's going to be a strange thing.
Oh, man.
To walk in. I mean,
it'll be like going to Detroit every day. Oh, wait.
Yeah, you're right. Although people are using parts of Detroit to garden in their yards, and so there's some innovative things going on there.
Uh-huh.
Sounds like some great places for zombie movie sets. So Paris is going to come and go, of course, and nothing will happen.
Right. Nothing of substance. I'm sure that people will talk and might even sign an agreement regarding some emissions reduction starting in 2030 or 2040 or 2030, some point at which no humans are remaining on the planet. Yeah. So I'm pretty sure emissions will be reduced at that point.
I'm just wondering if we're going to get a little hopium bump because of the conference. You know, I don't know, Leonardo DiCaprio talks, somebody else talks, a couple people throw a couple things out there that we're doing, and then, you know, they make CNN headlines for a couple weeks, and people feel good about what we're doing again, and we just kind of put off what actually needs to be done, which is, you know, we talk about living in the moment. I don't think people can actually wrap their mind around something like that. That's not doing something to them, apparently.
Right. No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, this is how the show keeps going, right? This is why the plates are still on the air while the so-called powers that be are running around shaking the sticks to keep them up in the air, is that every year we have something like this Conference of Parties agreement that comes along and distracts people. And
they do seem to come more often. We have a caller?
We do have a caller. Malcolm from Oakland. We're taking your question.
Yeah, hi.
Hello.
I enjoy your program, and I heard you're like, hey, we need a caller. So I was like, I got plenty of, you know, thoughts and interests in this in your topic here. First, I'd like to say I really appreciate the humor that you guys have over such a dismal and upsetting topic, and I think that's really important. And I think it's actually one of the reasons why people tend to steer away from this topic is because, well, it's depressing and, you know, hard to handle. But I think that humor is a great way to navigate some of these areas and in a way that's healthy. And, you know, it doesn't serve anybody any good to be depressed, you know. On the other hand, like, actually, you know, we need to do something, right, and have some kind of sense of responsibility or some action. And I guess of the myriad of questions or comments I would have for you, one of the things that I'm curious to know is what you feel would be, you must have in your mind the sort of like played out scenarios, potential scenarios of a collapse or of, the end of the civilization as we know it. And I'd be curious to just know, how do you guys envision that? Because it's a little, there could be a number of ways, you know. I mean, I hear you mention that there's just going to be no more humans left, but maybe there's going to be a different version of, you know, how humans survive, like you were saying earlier in the program, that we've survived without the type of civilization or the structured world that we have for, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And I like how you were pointing about, and we seem to just be obsessed about the part where civilization happened. So I don't know, like, do you have any, I don't know if, are you guys preppers? Are you guys planning? Or are you guys just sort of cooling your heels and waiting for the end time? So I guess that's my question. What do you think about when you imagine the transition from this world to the next world?
Okay. I'll start. I read an article, and it was the way I was introduced to Guy in 2008, and the headline was basically, "It's the end of the world as we know it." And it was an op-ed piece in the Arizona Republic, and my dad gave it to me, which he entirely regrets to this day. And I read it, and it really began a journey for me. And I went on and called Guy with a couple of my colleagues. I was teaching high school at the time, and asked him about pretty much the question you just asked about what it would look like. And I don't exactly remember. He gave three things to kind of look for, and I think one of them was, you know, your bank is no longer open, was a major one. And another one might have been that the lights had been out for a few days, and they may not come back on because it's not necessarily just your normal power outage. And I don't exactly remember the third. It might have been something like the water is not coming out of the municipal taps. And those are some of the things he said. And so when I began, down the path that I'm still on, I was more concerned about what it was going to look like and what I was going to do about it and how I was going to navigate that. And since, and that was 2008, since then I've left my job. I live in a Mongolian yurt and without any electricity really and any running water, but, and I'm not a prepper. I think my focus in the beginning was to be a prepper, but I've come to the point where I think I'm just trying to enjoy my life and not, and I've really enjoyed the fact that I don't have to show up to a place every day. And I enjoy teaching, but it was the idea that I had to go there and I had to follow a curriculum, which I no longer agreed with. And so for me, it's really become more of, and it sounds, it's so cliche today, but really being more mindful and being in the moment. And I wake up every day and I got a huge smile on my face and I'm like, so what's going to happen today? It doesn't mean I don't stress about money or things like that. And I certainly do live in the monetary system. And so there are times where I need to bring money in and I have a savings and, you know, that, of course, that dwindles as well. So it's really not a prepper's mentality or survival mentality or really necessarily what the scenario is. It's really trying to just, I guess, live the life. I guess living instead of making a living is the best way of putting it. And I've really kind of done that the last 3 years, and a guy can add to that.
I like that. I wish I'd have thought of that years ago, because I actually started out as a prepper. I envisioned the day that industrial civilization would fall, according to a guy named Korowicz, David Korowicz, writing for the Foster Group. I think it was June 30th, 2012. It annoys me that this kind of thing sticks in my head, by the way, June 30th, 2012. He says it could be as little as 3 weeks after any particular part of civilization seizes up that the whole house of cards comes down. So it could be, you know, the credit market seizes up, and 3 weeks later, there's no water coming through the taps. It could be the food not getting transported up or down the Mississippi River in the United States, and 3 weeks later, there's no water coming through the taps. It could be oil supply, as happened in the 1970s in the United States. It could be that the price of oil is too low to allow the fracking boom and the tar sands boom to continue, and so we have disruptions in the supply of oil that caused within a relatively short time later the banks to all fail and people stop showing up at their work and the nuclear power facility all melting down and so on. So I started out as a prepper, and it has become clear in the consequent many, many, many years. It's been 6.5 years since I left active service at the University of Arizona, and it was a year and a half before that I committed to this particular place. And it's become pretty apparent since then that when the house of cards comes down, almost certainly habitat will be lost for all humans in the very near future because of the loss of global dimming. The sulfates and aerosols in the atmosphere, when they all fall out, we're going to observe extremely abrupt warming, sufficient to cause lost habitat for all humans on the planet within a matter of weeks, maybe months. And so, you know, we didn't know that in 2007 when I committed to this operation. But on the other hand, it could continue to play out as it has so far, which, you know, all the macroeconomic measures with which I'm familiar peaked in 99 or 2000. Well, that's 15 or 16 years ago, and yet we still have water coming through the taps at most of the cities in the United States. We still have food on the shelves and so on.
Yeah, there's personal collapse around the world for different nations, different individuals, different communities.
That's right.
You and I, and I'm assuming Malcolm, have not faced or felt.
Right. Yeah.
And that's been going on for, well, centuries.
Absolutely. One individual, one family at a time,
right,
runs into a situation that their daily survival is threatened.
Right.
We do have another caller. This one comes from Gia in Washington, D.C. Gia, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, thank you. I love you, Dr. McPherson. You're a rock star to me. You touched on a little bit of the question that I wanted to ask. It was about global dimming. I'm in Washington, D.C., and my family has a peach tree and a fig tree, And I noticed that this year, out of all the years that they've had the trees, the harvest or the fruit from it is very, very small. So I was thinking that it was possibly the global dimming effect or the solar dimming. Could you elaborate on solar dimming?
Yeah, this global dimming is allowed by the particulates that are put up into the atmosphere by industrial civilization, most notably aerosols and sulfates from burning poor quality coal. I suspect what you're seeing, Gia, in Washington, D.C., and that area, is not because of the loss of global dimming, because that really hasn't started yet, but instead it's probably from ozone. And Gail Sawacki at Wits End writes about this prolifically. The ozone we pollute into the atmosphere, and the results at the level of the atmosphere are causing trees to die throughout the globe, and that's been going on for quite a long time, but it apparently is accelerating. So this is a phenomenon, again, rooted in the predicament of civilization. And so that's where it all starts. And in my opinion, it all keeps going until it stops. And there's all kinds of individual contributing factors, including ozone, pollution, erosion, the sixth mass extinction, as well as abrupt climate change. You know, all these things are rooted in that one central factor, and we aren't doing anything about that.
All right, well, that's our show. We pulled it off, Guy.
Stunning, isn't it? It amazes me every time, even when they do have a guest.
Yeah. I hope Paul is safe out there on his bike. So that about wraps it up this week. Make sure to like us on Facebook, Nature Bats Last, and Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM, and feel free to post questions you'd like us to address on the show. Please continue to follow Guy's blog at GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. We'll see you on the radio next Tuesday afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern. We'll be quoting from several perceived leaders in the global change arena, global climate change, including scientists and activists. We'll probably be a little bit impolite about it, but, hey, it's nothing new. If you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives at PRN.FM and rate us on iTunes. Thanks again for your calls this week and to Afrozen for his music. And until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
it's your best laugh.
Coming out swinging, she bats last, and she's just a